Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza, and we are the kettle selection department. We order the majority of kettles collection. Welcome, ladies.
Hello.
Hello. And I'm going to, we have a special podcast today.
Because, yes,
and
we do. Let Mari take over. My name is Mari, and I'm the Youth Services Collection Development Specialist here. And we have a special guest today. Kate Newcomb has kindly joined our administration staff. We are so excited to have her, not just on the podcast, but here in administration, because she is now managing the Summer Reading Challenge, which is always an amazing time where we've been getting ready for it for a long time. So welcome, Kate. You want to tell us a little bit about what's coming up with the Summer Reading Challenge this year, and then maybe tell us about some books as well as the theme?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. So summer reading, as Mari mentioned, is always huge. It's really sort of one of our bread and butter cattle programs. It starts on June 6th this year, runs through August 9th. Registration begins on June 1st. And there are a couple big changes to summer reading this year. One of them is that in the past, and as long as I can remember, we have tracked and logged our summer reading based on minutes and hours. Is that correct, Mari? Is that as long as I've been at Cal?
Yeah, more or less. Okay. More or less, for sure. I mean, from the time I've been here, I remember seeing,
yeah,
you know.
That's yes.
And, you know, that has been interspersed with fun activities that you can do to also earn points towards your reading. But this year, we're changing it up a little bit. And instead of counting time, we are counting days. So you don't need to keep track of how long you read on any given day. You just keep track of the fact that you read at all. Maybe you had a light reading day and you just got 5 minutes in on your, you know, phone while you were waiting to go into the dentist. Maybe you had a great, like, lazy Saturday where you read all day. It doesn't matter if you read.
I love it.
You read, cross it off. You know, we are hoping that that makes it easier for the users, you know, to track their reading, and also easier for the staff. As branch staff, we've all had the experience of, like, being at the desk when a family comes up to log their reading and you've got five different kids with five different reading levels and activities that they've done. This way, it's just cross it off, you're done, everybody gets their prizes and is happy. And on the prize note, another big change is that a book has always been, like, your completion prize. If you read, you know, if you finish all the levels, you get a book. This year, a book is the first prize.
Amen. That has long been my hope and my fantasy, so it will be alive this summer.
Your fantasy is fulfilled. So, you know, we're really just emphasizing our mission, which is books. There are summer reading programs at lots of places, like, you know, Nothing Bundt Cakes does a summer reading program. You know, there's summer reading all over the place. But we are a place for books. So we are launching you out into the world with your book as your first prize. Super excited about that.
Yeah, I really love that you're making it, like, just let's all develop a daily habit of reading.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
It doesn't matter whether you're a 20-minute a day kid or a 3-hour a day kid or a 5-minute or a 4-minute at the table. You know, it's nice.
Just creating that habit, though, is just a real.
Yeah. So what's our theme this summer?
I'm so happy that you asked. Our theme is Color Our World. It's beautiful. The artwork is beautiful. It's all about art and color and art in, you know, whatever that means to you. And so I wanted to talk about a couple books that really fit in that theme. I'm a real picture book person. That is, like, my love and my field of expertise. So I've got a couple that I would love to share. The first one is called Maybe Something Beautiful by F. Isabel Campoy and Teresa Howell. And it is, you know, on the front of the book, it tells you that it's based on a true story. So you're kind of reading it thinking, oh, you know, what's this story? And it's about a little girl named Mira who lives in a gray city. And she loves to draw and doodle. And as she walks to school every day, she hands everyone she sees, she gives them her art. And it sort of beautifies the community in which she lives. And so one day she's walking home from school and she meets a muralist who's about to paint a wall, and he's kind of sizing it up, and he says, maybe it could be something beautiful. And so she joins in with his painting because she tells him, I'm an artist. So they begin to paint together, and then the whole community begins to paint together, and they transform their gray city into this beautiful, colorful city. And the really cool sort of twist is that at the end, there are notes about the actual origin of the story, and it is that the illustrator, Rafael Lopez, of the book, is the person who created the urban art trail in San Diego. So he and his wife is a graphic designer and a community organizer, they wanted to like transform their sort of gray little city walk. And so they invited the whole community to join in. So this really happened in their community, that the community created this like beautiful collaborative piece of art. So it's just a beautiful book that is Maybe Something Beautiful by F. Isabel Campoy and Teresa Howell. My second book is just a much simpler book. It's a perfect, truly like the perfect read aloud. It's called Dog's Colorful Day by Emma Dodd. She's like, you know, when you're a person who does story times, Emma Dodd is like, you know, one of the all-timers. Her books are just perfect, and this is an absolutely perfect book. The subtitle is A Book About Colors and Counting, and it's about a dog, and at the beginning, you learn that dog is white with one black spot on his left ear. And as the book goes on, dog collects colors via, you know, a splot of jam lands on his back. You know, a splotch of grass gets on him when he rolls in the park. So as the book goes on, he accumulates, by the end of the book, he has 10 different spots. And it's just, like I said, just a perfect, simple book that lends itself to so many fun, like enriching, you know, projects that you can do at home. It's the greatest. And at the end, he, spoiler alert, takes a bath and is once again dog with one black spot.
Nice. Nice.
So that's Dog's Colorful Day by Emma Dodd. Those are two just perfect books that fit in so nicely with our Color Our World summer reading theme.
Awesome. Lovely. Awesome. Well, I do have a couple of picture books that I want to bring to our podcast today. The first one is I'm Sorry You Got Mad by Kyle Lukoff. And this was actually a book from last year that ended up on all sorts of lists, like just honor lists and maybe even a few awards out there. This is a book about a boy who is tasked with giving an apology to his classmate. Mrs. Rice is like very insistent that he get it right. He has knocked over a castle. And I'll say, too, that this is really in the vein of, like, you know, that social-emotional learning. Like, you can just feel the feelings that the children and the teacher is feeling. But what I really liked about it is that the illustrator, who is Julie Kwan, did a great job of just, like, totally, perfectly, like, setting up the, it's either a preschool or kindergarten, I'm not quite sure, the classroom. It's just amazing. The teacher's got, like, her Dance Go clogs, which made me laugh. She's got her Lands End khakis. I'm putting Lands End in there. I'm not sure if they were really Lands End, but it's just a really an amazing setup. But Jack is, like, he keeps writing these letters, you know, and they're not quite what the teacher wants. Mrs. Rice is like, okay, finally, she's like, she says, a real apology has to say three things: what I did, that I'm sorry, and I'll help you fix it. I'm like, oh, wow, thank you for reminding me, Mrs. Rice, because that's really important to, like, present an apology without, like, but, well, if you wouldn't have, you know, that those sorts of excuses. And he goes through all that. And so, you know, one of the examples that he's, like, responding with his letters, he's got several attempts of the letter. I knocked over your castle. I'm sorry, I guess. you could build another one if you wanted to, and I won't knock it down again, all right? I mean, it's just that sort of thing. But what you learn is that Jack actually has, like, some feelings going on about, like, what actually happened. And there's so much more to the story than Mrs. Rice really knows. So the last thing I'm going to say about the book is that I read it last year, and then this year I checked it out as a Wonder Book. For those of you who don't know, Wonder Books are picture books and fiction books that have, like, a little BMP3 player in it. So it's a way to listen to the book. And this section, this BMP3 also has what they call a learning mode, where there are questions asked of you, like, you know, what was your favorite scene? Or what do you think Jack should have done? Or just these questions to really think about. So that was really nice. Quickly, I'm also going to mention the story of the house that hid Anne Frank. And this is by Thomas Harding, illustrated by Britta Tenkentrop. Let me see if I say that correct. Tenkentrop. Well, I'm not sure. I thought she was Dutch, but maybe she is German. Originally written overseas. Let's just say that. It was written overseas. And if you are familiar with The House by the Lake, which is also by Thomas Harding and Britta Tenkentrop, this is kind of in that same way, except this book describes the story of the house in which Anne Frank and her family hid during World War II. It is an amazing story. I mean, you learn that this house was actually constructed back in 1580. I mean, It's beautiful illustrations, beautiful collage artwork. The church was constructed that was down the street in 1635. I mean, lots of rich history. So this book kind of goes through all the different families that lived in this house and when the periods of time when it was in disrepair. Just amazing, amazing story. I've heard about this house my whole life. I remember reading the diary when I was a kid. And just to have the focus be on the book or on the house and just be like, wow, this is, it has seen so much love and desperation and large families. I mean, one of the first families had like 12 or 13 children living in it. It was just amazing. So I really recommend that you get a hold of it's actually The House on the Canal. The House on the Canal is the title, not The House That Hid Anne Frank. It's the story of the house that hid Anne Frank. So thank you.
Can I jump in on that? Yeah. I just read The House on the Lake, not knowing that you were going to talk about this, and I love it. And I was thinking about bringing that to a future podcast episode.
That's a gorgeous book.
It's an amazing story, also set in Germany, about this house and all the history and World War II. And it's just a phenomenal book.
Also by Harding, right?
Yeah, yes. Right. Same author, same illustrator. And the Britta Tenkentrop is just... I mean, it's exquisite.
That's new art to me, and it's beautiful. The cover is really beautiful.
Yeah, it is really beautiful.
So beautiful. Yeah. I also wanted to say something really quick about the Wonder Books. I guess I didn't know that that was an aspect of those. And I think about patrons when I used to be in the branches that wanted things for their kids about reading comprehension. Because they were told by a teacher, your child is reading okay, but the comprehension of your child is very poor. Mm-hmm. That's really an excellent way to use those books to assist.
It really
reading
gives you a moment to reflect on, like, okay, what did I just hear? What did I just read? Well, you know, or even like, what's your opinion of the story between, you know, Jack and Zoe? They were having problems. Well, you know, I really appreciate kids being able to express themselves and talk about what they heard.
Exactly. And it's hard to find those. Yeah. I remember having a hard time finding resources for comprehension in particular with our collection and with what we had. So, cool. Right.
Can I jump in really quick with one more picture?
But
just because I'm excited about
it. Yeah.
This is new, as in I think we just got it in April. It's called Don't Trust Fish by Neil Sharpson. And the artist is Dan Santat, which is why I grabbed it. We have talked about him before. I've talked about him before, actually, on previous podcasts. He's a Calicut medalist. This really made me think of a book Marty really just recently talked about, the nonfiction children's book. My presentation today is about the anaconda.
Yeah.
In that this book starts off with basically the narrator saying, like, it's like this animal has fur, this animal is warm-blooded, this animal feeds her baby's milk, this animal is a mammal. And it goes through and it starts, but then it hits fish. And it says, this is a fish. Don't trust fish. And it just goes on, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
The pictures are wonderful. Some fish do this, some fish do that. Just don't trust fish. I mean, it's sort of that feeling. The expressions on the faces of the fish are wonderful. It shows quite a variety of fish. It shows how big they can get. It posits that they might be plotting against us. It tries to lure you into a sense of maybe you can trust some fish, but tells you no, you cannot trust fish. And eventually it sort of goes back to the more of the report style, nonfiction style description, but really it's just don't trust fish. But the artwork is wonderful. And it really is a very funny book.
Yeah.
So, and I'm just excited about it because cool. I love Dan Santet's art
cool.
and humor. So I wanted to mention that. You want to jump in or do you want me to go with the next one?
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, the first book that I planned to talk about is How We Show Up, Reclaiming Family, Friendship, and Community by Mia Birdsong. This is a really sort of in the sense of community building. It's an invitation to community building. Birdsong sort of came to this. She's had multiple experiences like this, but she'd had a particularly deep experience of being called into a group of educated, interesting women and asked to sort of just talk about the world and the things that they see and, you know, come up with ideas, brainstorm, you know, just sort of see what they could come up with in a weekend getaway, just a weekend away just to talk and think. And she came away thinking that was such an important and moving experience for her, and she just wanted to think about how we build community in our daily lives. And this is a book that really addresses that. There's no perfect way, but it gives a lot of different ideas and examples of things that people have done. It talks about the People's Kitchen in California. It talks about the experience of there are people who would dearly love just the idea of people dropping in. And then there's, it's like, Cheryl and I are like, the type A's who are like, I don't want people just dropping in. Yes. But there's workarounds for that. She sort of, this is a Birdsong created a, like, sent out an email to her closest friends and said, and it was like a multi-point email and said, we're going to create a week. It's a drop-in week. Anybody is welcome this week. If anybody on the mailing list, don't bring extra people outside of your kids. Kids and partners are welcome, but we're going to build community. You are welcome anytime, any day. This for dinner, and it was sort of finding ways to keep connected with people, to build community, and it's sort of in response to, you know, we have. She even talks about kind of the negative aspects of the nuclear family. We go out, we leave our, you know, our birth families, we don't necessarily stay connected and have that community that was more important to getting kids raised, getting, you know, having, we run into the issues of babysitting and all these sorts of things because we don't have the extended family that would have done it in the past and the extended community. So it's sort of really looking at what steps we can take to build that. And I was listening to something that came up a couple of different ways. Evidently, a certain social media CEO was talking about how AI is going to become our friend. And I kind of object to that violently. And so it's this, there are better ways.
Yeah.
We actually should reach out in the communities that we're in and build community versus looking for a solution.
Even
in
if
meta
it's hard.
Or, yes, exactly. And it is. It's coming up with, it's giving ideas of ways to connect and go out. And so it's just a really, I think people would get a lot out of this one. And again, this is How We Show Up by Mia Birdsong.
Sounds really good and very relevant, timely.
Yes.
And our books were having a little bit of alchemy again, like they do almost every podcast. This is something, Kate, that happens to us. Like there's some sort of connections and we do not plan it. It just happens this way. The book that I'm going to talk about next is called My Friends by Hisham Mattar. And this was a novel that came out in 2024. And since then has won a lot of awards and been nominated for a lot of awards. I'm just going to list a few. The National Critics Book Circle Award, which we talked about last month. This was the fiction winner. The National Book Award was a finalist. The Orwell Prize for Political Fiction. Longlisted for the Booker Prize and a finalist for the Andrew Carnegie Medal. And I think it's notable to mention that just because that's a lot. And this came to me on an NPR interview where I heard the author speaking about the book. And I was like, wow, I need to read that. And then as it happens a lot, you know, it took me about a year to read it. And when I finally got it in my queue for the 50th time or something, I looked at it and said, okay, this is like a 400-page book. Is this really what I should be reading right now? And it's like this book wanted me to read it, okay? It feels like it drew me. And I put aside faster, quicker reads for this one. And I absolutely loved it. I want to shout out on the streets like Rissa wanted to last month about the book that they talked about. And I just... That's just how I feel. So this is a phenomenal work. It's very quiet. It's very meditative. And it is definitely a political novel. It centers on themes of friendship and exile. And the story of this is our narrator, main character, really is narrating sort of his life in the series in one night on a walk across London. And the cover's really cool because it's the head of a man, but if you see, the River Thames is right there in the head.
It's the man.
And so London features really prominently in this book. And so what happens is Khaled leaves during the Gaddafi regime and gets to go study literature in Edinburgh. And he loves literature. Literature really features strongly in this book, too. Lots of writers who wrote about exile. The idea of translation, the idea of reading English literature when you're Libyan, those things to tie into the book as well. But anyway, he goes there. He's studying. He's sort of swept up in the freedoms of Britain compared to Libya at the time. And he meets his friend, Mustafa. And Mustafa's like, hey, let's go to this protest. It's protesting the Gaddafi regime in front of the Libyan embassy in St. James Square. And Khaled's kind of a retiring, kind of reserved guy. He's scared because that's something he would not be able to do in Libya. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll just go. This guy, his friend's very charismatic, kind of pulls him into this. He's looking around at the protest. He sees some shifty-looking people in the front, and all of a sudden, gunshots go. And this is a real event, 1984, April 17th, in London. Some Libyan agents actually shot into the crowd. And our main character, Khaled, is pulled into this. He is shot. And he and Mustafa are both shot, and they come back from life. But now they're trapped because they're in the UK. They can't tell... Khaled can't tell his family what really happened because the phone wires were bugged. The phones were bugged. So he has to pretend and live this lie for quite a while. He's given, I can't think of the word right now. Oh my gosh. He's being protected by the government. They're watching over him, but he has to pick up the pieces of his life. He can't even go back to Edinburgh because there are moles. There are people embedded there with the Libyan community. So it's very dangerous. It's very sad because his family's like, you're acting a little weird. And he has to just write these letters back and forth. So in that way, it's very suspenseful and sort of terrifying. But the point of the novel really is about how he comes from this experience, how he builds this life that's very sort of light and airy. Reminds me of the title, The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera. You know, it's this sort of, he can't really settle. He has a hard time with intimate relationships because of it, because he's had to live this life of exile. But it's also about friendship and about Hawa, Rana, Mustafa, and him. And this man named Henry was a professor. And it makes me think of how we show up because these people show up for him.
Exactly.
He cannot really be with his family again. He loved his family, but he can't. Oh. So these people become sort of a family, and they challenge him, and they support him, and they... So it's about the friendship. It's about exile. It's about literature. It's about a love of London that he found as an exile and how he processed exile differently than Hossam and Khaled, who actually went and fought in the Arab Spring, and how he didn't, and why. So it's quiet, it's contemplative, it's really powerful, and I just thought it was exquisite novel. So
nice.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. You want to... You want to give us a couple more?
I would love to talk about another kind of art-themed book.
Cool.
This is for a slightly older crowd. This is for, like, you know, nine and up, depending on your reading level. This is a series by Blue Balliet. The first one is called Chasing Vermeer. And these books are, I will say, the first one is maybe 15 years old, so they're a little on the older side, but I'm sort of specifically talking about it today because I would love for them to have a little bit of a renaissance, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. It is, the series, it's a mystery series, and it's really in the tradition of, so like my favorite book ever is The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin, or like my favorite mm-hmm. kids book. It's in the tradition of a really thoughtful mystery like that, or like a Mysterious Benedict Society or Mr. Limoncello's Library. It has a puzzle aspect to it, and it opens on a warm October night in Chicago, and the writing is so beautiful. It describes a plump tangerine moon had just risen in the sky, and three people get letters dropped at their door, and the letters are asking for help to solve an art theft.
Ooh.
And mm-hmm. you know, the three people have very different reactions. And, you know, if you get a mysterious letter, you might feel targeted, scared, excited. And so a local teacher gets involved, and she has two students, Petra and Calder, who are not friends at the beginning of the book, but as the book goes on, they become friends because the teacher sort of tasks her students with trying to solve this mystery of this art heist. And the teacher is like a really funky teacher. I always loved in children's books when you'd have like a cool funky teacher who wears, you know, dangly, multiple dangly earrings and perhaps some Dansko clogs. And it's such a clever book. It's got illustrations, even though it's for an older crowd, it's got illustrations. Illustrations are by Brett Hellquist, who did the Lemony Snicket illustrations.
Yeah.
And
yep.
The books also have a little bit of a Lemony Snicket element, except that I think they're more sincere. They're not as snarky, and that's, you know, neither good nor bad. That's just the way that it is. And so the pictures themselves contain puzzles that you can solve to help you sort of get through. It's just, they're really great books. They're absolutely great for adults as well. Like, adults would absolutely appreciate them.
Yeah.
You really learn a lot about art, like specifically Vermeer, but in the other books, like there's one called The Calder Game, and that really focuses on the sculptures of Alexander Calder. Cool. And because the books are about, and you know, I'm trying to limit spoilers, but because the books are about kind of art replicas, it really, they examine what is art. Like, you know, why is it art if it's an original, but if it's a copy, we don't consider it art anymore. They're really thoughtful and quirky and fun. They'd be great for a certain kind of kid and a certain kind of adult as well. So that is the
very cool.
First one is Chasing Vermeer. Mm-hmm. It's by Blue Balliet. And there are four in the series at this point.
Yeah, and I'm going to look for them. You're right that they are kind of older.
They are getting
But I'm
going to
at least get some paperbacks back into the system.
Yay,
sometimes
thank you.
They get weeded out, but we do have at least one of them. So awesome. That
thank
sounds
you.
Great.
I think you bring up something cool about reading, adults reading middle grade fiction, mm-hmm. because I think sometimes we think, oh, no, I shouldn't do that. No, it's so good. I mean, it's like middle grade books. I mean, teen too. We have a lot of people like teen fiction, but gosh, this is like so many wonderful things.
Yeah. There really are. And, you know, that is sometimes the way that I will begin to explore a topic that I find interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if it's something that as an adult, like, no shame, I never learned about it.
Right.
Something
me too.
Like,
me too.
Yeah. You know, like, oh, I don't know that much about the Civil War, as an example. Yeah. Like, this is kind of my in, just,
right.
which
yeah.
isn't, you know, or like The Witch of Blackbird Pond. That's another great example of like learning about a historical era without necessarily having to start with an 800-page book about
it.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Reminds me of the Jeopardy.
Yep.
The Jeopardy person who said he championed.
He yes, yep. that he studied by reading a middle grade book.
Yeah. Book. Yes.
Yeah. Neat. Very neat. Well, I do have another book that I want to bring to the podcast. It is called Chicken Pox by Remy Lai. It's a graphic novel. I would say it's about grade 4 to maybe grade 8, depending on, again, your reading level. But because it's a graphic novel, it goes so quickly. I mean, it's maybe 200 pages, but it, like, less than a half hour, maybe, if you're an adult reader. It is so funny. It's about Remy Lai, who I didn't know was not from California. I thought, you know, that this artist, author was from the U.S., but she actually grew up in Indonesia / Singapore, and then eventually ended up in Australia. But she tells these stories about family life that are just hilarious. She is giving this story from the perspective of her sister, Abby, who is just kind of like flummoxed by her little siblings who are always bugging her. She refers to her home household as like the zoo because the kids are just running around all over the place. And what I really liked about the book is that you get pictures for what a large house in Indonesia looks like. You know, she's got a gated front, which reminded me of some of my family members in Mexico, with these large gates and people coming by to sell snacks. You know, I mean, we think of the ice cream man. Well, she had someone coming by to sell fried snacks, and Abby has tries to get out as much as possible from her little siblings because she's the big sister and doesn't want that responsibility. But she ends up with friends, and the friends are equally as funny. I mean, they're doing things like listening to their teenage sister's phone calls, and you know, it's just really funny things. But one of those friends ends up with the chicken pox. And about 2 weeks later, guess who else gets the chicken pox? Remy, Abby, all the kids get the chicken pox. And it is just a funny story of how they end up being, you know, stuck together for 10 days. They refer to the little marks on their all over their body as like looking like Chucky. Remember Chucky from that the scary horror movies? Just funny. But what I really want to give Remy a lot of credit for, she gives a lot of really good information. And I'm always someone who's looking for vocabulary in books. And she starts out with, like, you know, talking about what are the stages of chickenpox. You've got red bumps or papules. Papules, I'm pretty sure I would not have known what that word was when I was in fifth grade. What they look like, them being really itchy. The next stage being vesicles, like these watery, gross things that come out. I mean, I got to tell you that with everything that's in the news regarding the measles, and then reading this book about the chickenpox, I did feel a little itchy. Like,
yucky. Oh, no.
I think she does an amazing job of like sharing also like the factual aspects of, you know, what's involved in getting the chickenpox, mm-hmm. and how do you recover, and why is it that her parents didn't get it while they had it when they were little, and usually you don't get it again, and that sort of thing. It was just a really wonderful book. I really liked it. And shout out to MacGyver. Was mentioned in the book as well. Does anybody remember this? So the setting is sometime in the 90s. I'm not sure if MacGyver is really from the 90s. I thought it was from the 80s, but maybe they were watching reruns or something in that part of the world. So yeah, I loved it.
And is that a semi-autobiographical?
Yes, okay. It is. I mean, she does have this family of five little siblings and just how they grew up. And, you know, it's not her perspective. It's written from the perspective of Abby, the older sister.
Okay.
So, but Remy does the writing and the illustration. So really nice.
Yeah.
Okay, to follow with humor.
Yes.
And maybe more graphic information on some topics than people would care to want. No. I read Dreadful by Caitlin Rosakis. My book discussion group, the Downtown Lansing's speculative fiction book discussion group, just did this. It is high fantasy comedy. And I will absolutely, I am 99% certain I picked it up I'd seen it a couple of times, but I think I picked it up because local author Jim C. Hines did a quote for it. So quotes do help. I'm totally fine with not getting quotes. I think there's a move to not do that because it takes away from people actually writing the books that we like. But it did catch my eye and made me go back and look at this. It takes on every fantasy trope in some way or another, and turns it on its ear. It opens with the narrator basically waking up, unsure of what's gone on, had been out cold on the floor in what he recognizes as a wizard's laboratory. He's there, out cold, without any eyebrows, and slowly but surely realizes he's probably the evil dark wizard, and not a terribly competent one at that. And it's him waking up, realizing he's in the middle of a big, giant conspiracy, and doesn't know the rules, doesn't know the plan. There are people who are bigger and darker than him, probably more competent. And he basically wants to be good now and wants to survive. And those two things are kind of in opposition sometimes. But there are crazy, weird killer moat squid. He's recovering from toxic masculinity somewhat. There's the evil wizards, and there's a garlic festival. And all of these things lead to a very interesting story. And one of the things that I loved about it is the way it looks at the masks that we put on. Mm-hmm. 'Cause there's a lot of this is, building yourself up because that's what people expect, or creating a facade that will get your point across when you might not be able to do that with your normal looks or normal demeanor. So and I like the way it discusses it. I like the way it kind of plays with it, with the different characters. The goblins are wonderful. Definitely worth reading just for the goblins, I think. So.
Cool.
It's just a fun one.
Sounds fun. My last book here is Raising Hair, a Memoir by Chloe Dalton. And this is a genre that I particularly love, and I hold back talking a lot about on the podcast because I think I exclusively read these types of books for like 10 years straight or something like that. So I try to back off a little bit so I don't inundate you. I'm a huge animal lover. This one in particular has been really popular, had some pretty famous actor blurbs. You've got Amy Sedaris, Angelina Jolie. So it was one that was kind of interesting because I heard about it first. I follow a lot of British books that came out in England first.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I need to read that. And I thought it was just one of those quirky books that I would really like that I'll read a year from now when it gets published in the U.S. And then I see all these famous people talking about it, Margaret Renkel, the author.
Yep.
So it made a big stir, and that's great. What I think stands out for me about this memoir, because is really the tone of it. Chloe Dalton is a speechwriter and a political analyst, largely based in London, but she has a sort of countryside house, and then she was there during the pandemic. And her tone of the book is very, it's a little bit more removed than some other books like H's for Hawk, which is my favorite book of all time, and is a very intimate memoir about herself. I think Chloe Dalton's self is a bit removed in this book. It really is more about the hair and about how this hair entering her life changed her life in so many ways. So she finds this leveret, which is what a baby hair is called, and she's like, oh no, this is not looking good. It's going to get eaten. It's like a little injured. It's going to get eaten by a dog. So she pulls it in, but it's really, really hard to find what to do with a hair. That's not something that there's a lot of information about. They're very different than rabbits, and they easily die of like panic and shock. They're so not domesticated in any way. Of course, they're wild, but even less so than a wild rabbit. I mean, you have to be very, very careful. So she pulls it in, and she tries to figure out what to do. She can't find much assistance. And so she goes to this whole body of literature, which is part of the book, about hairs. And it's everything from witchcraft. Witches all had hairs, of course. If you see a hair, a witch will have a pet hair. It's all very negative. It's about hunting hairs, eating hairs, cooking hairs. Nothing really that helpful about taking care of hairs. She finds in an old book something about porridge, so she gives it porridge and it actually eats it. But the beauty of this book to me is how she cares for the hair. She adapts her entire house so it can come in and out of her home, but she doesn't really mess with it. it's not about how it becomes her best friend and it cuddles in her bed, which it does kind of snuggle with her, actually, a little bit. But it's about how she respects its space and alters her life to give it access to her home. And it does like to sit next to her while she works. But then it goes out and it's wild. It has babies. She sees it out in the field, which is terrifying for her because she knows that hares get killed by farm machinery. They get killed by other animals. They don't often make it very long in their very short lives. So she has to love it from afar in this very extremely respectful way. So in that aspect, it was a unique animal memoir, and she's a very elegant writer. And I don't want to read too much, but I just wanted to say this. It really sums up the book for me. She needed nothing from me other than that I do her no harm, which might serve as a motto for all wild animals. All she required was a little space, a patch of sun in which to lie, and peace. This realization made her continued presence in the garden and the house all the more precious, since it was by choice. So a really unique, rich nature memoir, animal memoir. And 80% of hares have, we have 80% fewer hares in England in the last century. So this is a species that, she talks a bit about that too, and what things that we can do to protect hares, protect these wild animals. So, really interesting.
Fascinating. Okay. All right. I think that's what we have for today.
Yeah.
Thank you all. Thank you, Kate, for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It was fun having you
and
on.
And happy reading, everybody.
Happy reading.
Yay.